how about a little George Orwell to serve as an inspirational kickoff for episode 160 of The Far Middle? I think we could use that. Now, one of the best observations from Orwell, and there have been many, was the following. In a world of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. Yeah, that man spoke truths that resonate to this day and that serve as a tiny bit of inspiration for the Far Middle podcast. Nick DeOlius here. I'm glad you are here with me as well. Let's jump right into our sports dedication. It's another one that has something to do not only with sports, but also has much more to do with society, and in this case, big business and fashion. The dedication should be of interest to both sports fans as well as general listeners alike. Subject, he's another person from my neck of the woods, Western Pennsylvania. He grew up the son of a coal miner in Trafford, Pennsylvania, which is about 17 miles east of Pittsburgh. And you may not know of him, but you know well two famous associations that he has, one with Nike and one with Michael Jordan. And you know what he catalyzed as a fashion creation, Air Jordan shoes. And you know the actor that played him in the movie Air, who was Matt Damon, which is sort of funny because Matt Damon looks nothing like this man. Now, our dedication subject's full name is John Paul Vincent Vaccaro, but his mother gave him the nickname Sonny. And it stuck. Sonny Vaccaro was always around the basketball world. He created what was once the premier amateur basketball showcase in the nation, the Dapper Dan Roundball Classic in Pittsburgh. You had Shaq and Ewing, Dominique, they all played in it. And then he later created the ABCD camp where Kobe and LeBron took part before going pro. But he started working for Nike in 1977. And while Vaccaro was a school teacher in his hometown of Trafford, the budding entrepreneur developed prototypes for different types of sneakers, including what he called a more casual, more stylish tennis shoe and a basketball sandal. And he traveled to Oregon to present them to Nike. And it was perfect timing for Nike, who wanted to get into the basketball market. At that time, Nike was a running shoe company, nothing to do with basketball, Vaccaro said. And then he added, I said, you want to get involved in college basketball? Pay the coaches. We'll give free shoes to all the teams, and the kids will wear the shoes. In his first year with Nike, Vaccaro signed top college basketball programs to the company. UNLV, remember our Jerry Tarkanian dedication way back, and Duke included. Nike paid the coaches $2,000 and gave the team free sneakers. Before you knew it, then Indiana State player Larry Bird, he's on the cover of Sports Illustrated in a pair of Nike shoes. But, of course, the biggest deal of Vaccaro's career was the inspiration for the film Air. That was convincing Nike to offer Jordan, MJ, a shoe deal in 1984. Before, by the way, Jordan even played a game for the Chicago Bulls, who drafted him. Nike wanted to get a signature athlete who was going to be a signature marketing icon, Vaccaro said. And Nike was considering endorsement deals to other players like Hakeem Olajuwon and Charles Barkley and John Stockton. But Vaccaro persuaded Nike to go after Jordan and offer him the entire budget rather than splitting it amongst different and multiple players. And to make the shoe also in the Bulls' team colors of red, black, and white. Vaccaro claimed he was able to convince Jordan, who by the way wore Converse shoes in college and was rumored to want to sign with Adidas, to sign with Nike when he told Jordan that Nike wanted to name a sneaker after him. So Jordan signs a then-record 5-year, $2.5 million contract with Nike in 1984 for the Air Jordan line. Nike's goal was to make $3 million in 3 years off the Jordan sneakers. The first shoe made $126 million in just 1 year. Not too bad. Phil Knight, the Nike founder, disputes, by the way, how much influence Vaccaro played in the Jordan saga, and Knight eventually did force Vaccaro out of Nike. Sonny Vaccaro is certainly an original, came from humble roots, took the initiative, innovated, helped build a behemoth global business, impacted sport and fashion, and he'll tell you all about it and then some if you just ask him. A fitting dedication for a brash episode 160. Speaking of behemoths and brash, let's make a connection into our primary theme for the episode. The behemoth is the administrative state and government. The brash is President Trump. The two look to be on an epic collision course, and you can't, and frankly shouldn't, look away. because the stakes are high for all of us. So let's dive in. Two episodes ago on The Far Middle, we explored the timely issue of excessive administrative state power and executive branch overreach and how those things upset the checks and balances of our constitutional system of government. I got a lot of feedback the past 14 days on that topic. And since it is such an expansive and unfortunately timely topic these days, this issue of administrative state and bureaucratic overreach and how it violates the checks and balances and branches of government frameworks in the Constitution, it's a topic I'm always running out of Far Middle time to fully cover. Which brings me to a specific item within this theme that I've had on a list to discuss with you constant listeners for a couple of months. And it's a glaring lack of consistency and frankly, misinterpreting an issue related to separation of powers within government. Not surprisingly, the lack of consistency, the misinterpretation or perhaps misrepresentation, depending on your view, it occurs across mainstream media, including the biggest names in business media. And oh yeah, it involves everyone's top polarizing figure, President Donald Trump. Now, as I always do on The Far Middle when discussing President Trump, let me remind that I am not here to shill for him or any other politician. I'm a classic liberal, fiscal conservative, and a libertarian philosophically. So I'm going to be for any politician who is socially liberal, fiscally conservative, and favors small government. And if neither choice in an election reflects that perfect mix, which is the case I'll admit for most elections, and certainly the one coming up this November, then I choose the candidate that is closer to or closest to my perfect mix. So call it the lesser of two evils, if you like. But elections, you know, they're not about looking for necessarily the ideal candidate as much as they are about making a choice between the two or three options at hand. Okay, now I've seen this issue, as I've said, being mangled across numerous outlets from cable to print, including a recent column this year by a writer for the Wall Street Journal, one that I enjoy reading regularly, by the way. But he's dead wrong on this issue. And his column was the spark to bring the discussion to The Far Middle. The title of the column was Trump Allies See Path to Pad His Power. The topic swirls around what would happen with a potential Trump election victory in November, which of course is a big if. And President Trump's ongoing battle with the administrative state and his effort to, as he references it, drain the swamp. That was, of course, his rallying cry or campaign slogan back in 2016, and it's now been procured by the anti-Trump crowd as really standing for a grab for unprecedented power in line with something that you'd see with a strongman or a dictator, which is ironic, as we will see. That's the lack of consistency and lack of logic part of the topic. And that's going to be true whether you love or hate President Trump. And interestingly, everyone agrees, from the center right to the center left, that over the past decades and presidential administrations, heck, going back really to the era of Woodrow Wilson over 100 years ago, power in our federal government has been shifting from the legislative branch in Congress to the presidential or executive branch in the White House. Again, starting with Woodrow Wilson, but then exponentially expanding with FDR and the New Deal, and then LBJ with his Great Society, then President Obama, and now with President Biden. Most of us have been asleep as this shift in power from legislative to executive branch has occurred, partly because it happened slowly and methodically over a century. It's sort of like the story about the best way to boil a frog is to put the frog in the water at room temperature and then slowly raise the temperature by heating it versus throwing the frog into a pot of boiling water where it's going to jump out. But it is time to start paying attention. Troubling signs of this shift between legislative and executive branches in government are everywhere. For example, it's no wonder that recent jobs data show that government jobs grew at over 30 times the level that manufacturing jobs have grown in the United States. Yep, 30 times more. And that's what you get with our ever expansive and voracious administrative and bureaucratic state that resides within the executive branch of government in Washington, D.C. And you might be surprised to learn how many of those new jobs in government are not directly tied to a statute passed by an elected Congress. But that's another matter. So pundits and historians agree on this evolution of power shifting from sort of legislative branch and government to executive branch, as well as government playing a larger role than ever in the United States, to the point where government starts to, at a minimum, push against its limits and individual branches start to exceed the maximum roles and responsibilities laid out to it in the Constitution. But here's where the divergence and inconsistencies start to take root across media and the expert class. So the speculation is that former President Trump staffers or Trump administration staffers have been busy laying out a roadmap for what a second Trump term would look like from a policy perspective. And much of it involves, allegedly, once again, trying to drain the swamp and shrinking the administrative state. Personally, I like the sound of that because my view is that the current administrative state has grown not to the point of brushing up against constitutional limits, but grossly exceeding them. Scaling the behemoth back, in my view, is what needs to happen, not just what should happen. And I see a clinically objective shrinking of the bureaucratic deep state or behemoth as an entrenched class of regulators, that would be a win for individual rights and for the private sector and for capitalism. In other words, the pillars of these United States and our legacy, as well as our future if we desire continued success. But since this topic involves President Trump, again, the most polarizing figure perhaps in American history. By the way, there's an interesting topic for me to explore in a future Far Middle. What are the most polarizing figures in American history? Many of the elite and expert class, since this involves President Trump, whether center left or center right, they want to point at some of the potential tactics to be employed in a second Trump administration if he wins in November, and its desire to shrink the bureaucratic state. They want to point to those as a power grab of presidential authority that wasn't intended to reside within the executive branch per the Constitution. What? That's right, constant listeners. Trump critics, they're putting forth an argument that a possible effort to scale back an administrative state falling within the president's executive branch control, and that also is already beyond constitutional limits or norms, that's going to be a blatant power grab by the chief executive or president. That doesn't make any sense. How can you say by ceding power, the executive branch is grabbing power? Again, nonsensical. An effort to shrink the administrative state, one that's run over and beyond its banks and boundaries laid out by the Constitution, that ripped statutory power from Congress where it was supposed to reside, that took more authority and power and control from the individual citizen, that should be viewed as a power grab by a president akin to a dictator or a totalitarian regime. That's malarkey, as the current resident on Pennsylvania Avenue would say. Such a plan or view would be more Reagan-like than Mussolini-like. Reagan wasn't a dictator. He was a liberator of individual rights and defender of the Western way, because in part, he was a big proponent of smaller government. And I am not saying Trump is a Reagan. Trump's excessive government spending alone quashes that comparison. But on potentially shrinking the administrative state, Trump would be conjuring Reagan. Now, these esteemed critics of Trump, and many indeed are the esteemed elite as they hail from Ivy League schools and have spent careers in the power halls of government and society, they say they worry that shrinking the administrative state will hand Trump more power. That's once again odd. No, check that bizarre thinking, because the administrative state reports to the president under the Constitution. So how does shrinking the president's effective army or staff make the president or executive branch more powerful? Again, it doesn't make any sense. And then there are those who say that if you shrink government, it's going to harm different stakeholders. Now, this, of course, assumes government and the bureaucratic state, they're efficient service providers, and that they view the taxpayer as their boss, their client, and that they've got the public good always first in mind, and that they are competent. Yeah. And such an argument conveniently ignores that bigger government was created using the same logic on behalf of those same stakeholders, and those stakeholders have seen their plight worsen since government has grown. Like Ronald Reagan said, the scariest words known to mankind are, "Hi, we're from the government, and we're here to help. Run." Or Milton Friedman's observation that there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program. Those prior Trump administration staffers who might be looking to shrink bureaucratic authority, they've got a valid point. a lot of power in decisions that were supposed to be hashed out between Congress and the president. Today, they're made by a faceless and unelected entrenched permanent bureaucracy. We don't know them, we don't see them, and we're told to assume that they are independent and working in the best interests of those that they are sworn to serve. That's a foolish set of assumptions, as recent experience and mounting data suggest. Has homelessness improved or grown since the whole of government was thrown at it? Has energy security strengthened or weakened since the government grew to tackle climate change? Has inflation shrunk or grown since the Inflation Reduction Act was passed? Has the budget deficit shrunk or grown since all these budget and accountability offices have ballooned within government? Government typically makes things worse as it continues to grow larger. Today, nothing in the private sector in the United States gets done or moved without approval from the regulatory state and bureaucrats who staff it. What you eat, your profession, what you drive, what light bulbs you use, how you hire, what your airfare is, what you must label on your wares, and so on. You must ask, Mother may I, before you do anything in the private sector these days. And Mother is not Congress or the courts. It's not even the president. It's the behemoth administrative state. And it is a behemoth. Today's civil service adds up to around 2 million positions. And only 4,000 of the 2 million positions are presidential appointees, which would at least be one degree separated from a person elected by the voters. Which means the vast majority of the 2 million bureaucrats, they were put there without the American voter weighing in or even having one degree of separation via an appointee. Now, advocates of those faceless, unelected bureaucrats, they say that they are independent and nonpartisan, and they're in their positions because they earned it on merit. And that might be stretching things quite a bit these days, don't you think? But not according to that elite class. There's a professor at Georgetown in public policy who's convinced that, and goes around saying that, the research, and I'm not sure what the research is or what he's referencing, the research shows that political appointees in government are inexperienced, and that the unelected and entrenched bureaucrat is a noble individual that will keep political appointees accountable, and that the faceless bureaucrat serves a crucial role of potential whistleblower to call out the political appointee with any administrative, state, and executive branch activities. Come on, man. The bureaucrats are subjected to bias and self-interest like the rest of us. They are very partisan and heavily favor one of the two major parties. And I'm not sure how many of them are there because of the merit thing, or how many are excited to sort of perform at a level that's expected of them, or how many actually are exited from their positions when there's a clear lack of good job performance. What's worse, a bureaucrat who plays it straight, keeps their head down and performs their job as instructed by their elected or appointed boss, staying within the rules of law, or the bureaucrat who doesn't play it straight, is partisan, and selectively or creatively whistleblows for alleged or manufactured wrongdoing for the sake of disrupting? Go back to 2016, when Trump first took office, and recall what was tagged as the resistance. You remember that? Where bureaucrats, paid by us, across the administrative state, simply said, we don't like what the Trump administration stands for, and we don't agree with our policies, so we're going to simply refuse to follow orders and wait the administration out for 4 years. They basically said to the boss, as well as to the American voters who elected that person, that you're going to do what? Fire us? The wait and resist tactic get paid off, which tells you right there, this is a constitutional problem that's coming at the expense of the individual American citizen. It's a real current problem, not a hypothetical or abstract one. And by the way, many top civil servants in the federal government are not at-will employees. And most of us, we don't follow orders or policies at work. We face the consequences, and we might end up looking for a new job. But within a federal government bureaucracy, most employees know that they're not going to be able to be removed, even for the most egregious actions. So resistance and delay, they are absolutely options if the staffer is partisan or has an ideological agenda. Those things dictate what they do, not what the elected manager or boss or job duties require. That's a constitutional problem and a true threat to democracy. And many of the critics of Trump and shrinking the administrative state, they argue that doing so is going to allow Trump to unilaterally ignore the wishes of Congress when it comes to spending budgets and laws and things like aid packages. The fear-mongering goes something like this. A second Trump administration, it's going to result in delaying legislatively approved aid to Ukraine, or the Trump administration will refuse to follow the letter of the law that Congress will pass because the president didn't agree with the aid or the law. Yet that fear is exactly what is occurring today with the Biden administration. I'll give you two examples. Exhibit one is the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA. Now, the law is clear on specific aspects of the energy transition, and those specifics were hashed out between legislative members of Congress and also by intense negotiation with the executive branch. Senator Manchin of West Virginia, great example. He was in the middle of a lot of that. He had leverage as a key vote to get the IRA passed, and he made sure that certain provisions were encapsulated within the law. But once the law was signed, the Biden administration and the bureaucratic state, they're now arrogantly determining what they want the law to say and not say, which provisions to follow and which provisions of the law to ignore. That's unconstitutional. Exhibit two is the approved aid and military support to Israel as directed by Congress. Now, this one is a real-life parallel to the hypothetical fear of Trump delaying approved aid to Ukraine if the administrative state shrinks. Today, the Biden administration is purposely slowing down the delivery of approved munitions to Israel. We saw that in early May, supposedly to force the Israelis to the negotiating table in Gaza. But it doesn't matter the reason why, because that's purposely resisting approved law. That's unconstitutional. So where are the elites and the experts in constitutional law on these real and current examples? They should be running around like their hair was on fire when it comes to the unconstitutional power grab of the Biden administration occurring today, not the hypothetical what-if speculation about a possible future Trump administration tomorrow. Consistency, constant listeners. And to make this issue clearer, consider that Georgetown professor that I was mentioning. He speculates with an especially shocking whopper. He says, quote, "What if you have a president with authoritarian tendencies who wants to take control of the bureaucracy? That's the part that really terrifies me," end quote. Now, if the professor is terrified by that, then the Constitution must be even more terrifying to him, because the president, per the Constitution, runs the executive branch bureaucracy, not the bureaucrats themselves, not Congress, not the judiciary. The bureaucrat executes under the direction of the president the statute or regulation at hand. Congress decides what the law is that the president and executive branch and bureaucrat will enforce, and the judiciary makes sure that everything sits within the bounds and constructs of the Constitution. Fearing a president who will control or run the executive branch bureaucracy is fearing operation of government within the confines of the Constitution. And if you want to be terrified of those who are terrified of following the Constitution. Yeah, that's what I'm terrified of. Time flies when tackling big things on the far middle. There was so much more I wanted to get to, but hey, there's always next week's episode, right? Now to close, I just spoke about all these experts and elites who are terrified of another Trump term and how it might scale back the administrative state monster. And one promise made but never delivered on by the administrative state for decades has been within entities like the State Department, where the promise was nuclear weapon disarmament. Hasn't happened, and instead proliferation is blooming across the globe. And nuclear proliferation and the threat of nuclear war, those things indeed terrify me. Now, interesting, because this episode premieres on June 12th. That was the day in 1982 that throngs of people congregated for what was billed as the largest political demonstration in history. On the sunny morning of June 12, 1982, in Central Park in New York, people began to gather carrying signs for nuclear disarmament. More arrived from around the country, and by midday, Central Park was literally filled. And so were 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 6th, 7th, and Madison Avenues as more people tried to get to Central Park to participate. City officials estimated that over 750,000 people were in Central Park demanding an end to nuclear weapons, and by the end of the day, the crowd swelled to 1 million. Many called for an immediate end to all nuclear arms programs, especially with President Reagan's buildup of U.S. defense to confront the Soviet Union in the Cold War. The rally was entertained by performances from Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt, Bruce Springsteen, and James Taylor. I think there's a CD of select tracks from that day that you can purchase. I've heard some in the past. The sound quality is quite good, actually. And I do believe that Bruce and Jackson Browne performed together on that one. But the 40 years after the 1982 protest proved President Reagan right. The U.S. and the West, they toppled the Soviet Union. EU and U.S. weakness since has established enabled an ability of Russia to try to recreate the Iron Curtain with its invasion in Ukraine, using, by the way, nukes as threats. And Iran and North Korea, they're racing to nuclear capability if they're not there already, and they're rewarded by the West and by the U.S. with outright appeasement. It's a dangerous world, constant listeners, and we best stick to the proven formula of America. Individual rights, strong defense, small government, and a market-based private sector. It's worked in the past, and it's going to work in the future, and it's captured in the Constitution. Trust those things, not the bureaucrat. We hit more far middle themes next week. You have a great week. Bye for now.